Welcome, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Stonebridge Soundbites. My name is Patrick Kincaid. I'm the Director of Marketing and Relationship Manager at Stonebridge. With me today, we have Brad Stone, CFA. He works out of our Denver office. Brad, welcome.
Thanks, Patrick.
Well, I'm very excited to have you here. You're a new guest on our series here. You come with over 30 years of experience, and I'm just very excited to hear your point of view on a very interesting topic that we have today.
Look forward to sharing my views.
So it's February, and over the last several months, there's been a lot of conversation around interest rates. So for today, we thought a great conversation would be on interest rates, but the perspective of an investment manager. I'm very excited to have you with us, Brad, with your experience, not only working throughout market cycles, but working through different conditions like we're seeing right now. So it'll be very great to have your insight on all this.
Well, I've been like you said, I've been doing this a while, so I've seen a variety of interest rate environments, and mm-hmm. we're in a unique one today for sure. Mm-hmm.
So, Brad, I think to get us started, what would be great is to just give an overview of interest rates and how they work. Can you go through that with us?
Sure. Yeah, I got your questions last week, and so I've been giving this some thought, and I really want to keep it straightforward. It's easy to get caught up in the weeds of how bonds work and how the different kinds of bonds out there work. And I don't think that's useful. Really, I think the interesting thing about interest rates is that they reflect the cost of money. And by that, I mean, it's really pretty simple. I like the example of a grocery store going to a grocery store and buying an apple. And usually if you pick up the apple, there's a little sticker on it, or often there's a little sticker on it that says how much the apple costs. And if there's one apple in the grocery store and a lot of people want apples, that's going to be an expensive apple. And if there are 100 apples, the price is probably going to be lower than if there was one apple. And that's just basic supply and demand. So there's a similar idea at work in the bond market where that sticker on the apple is the interest rate of a bond. And people talk about interest rates. And what that means is there are lots of different kinds of bonds out there and lots of different kinds of stickers on the apple, if you will. Or each apple has a different sticker. I mean, it gets kind of nutty in a hurry. But most of the time when people talk about interest rates, they're talking about treasury rates. And they're in particular, they're talking about 10-year treasury interest rates. So you can envision the 10-year treasury as an apple with a sticker on it. And today, the price of that apple is about 2%. People also talk about short-term interest rates, and the price of those apples today is about 1.5%. So that's how I look at interest rates from a high level. And maybe for our purposes, that's saying enough without getting too far in the weeds here.
Yeah, absolutely. I can only imagine how deep you can get into this topic. So I think that's a really great analogy for us to look at it. When it comes to the Fed specifically and what drives them to make decisions on interest rates, how often do they make those adjustments? How do they go about making those decisions? Again, kind of high level for us here.
Yeah, the Fed Open Market Committee is the group of Fed governors that meets, I think it's 8 times a year. And they get together and talk about the economy and how strong economic growth is. They get together and talk about inflation, and they talk about the employment markets and the health of corporations and corporate earnings, all kinds of stuff that economists like to talk about. And the Fed, as you often read in the paper, has what they call a dual mandate, where they're charged with trying to keep inflation in check excuse me, and they're also charged with trying to keep the labor market healthy or to keep employment healthy. We want to keep jobs growing. We want to keep the jobs that are out there. We want to keep adding jobs to the economy so that as the population grows through immigration and through natural birth rate, there are more jobs out there for more people. And that's a good sign of a healthy economy. So the Fed cares about inflation and the Fed cares about employment primarily. The way the Fed has three main levers that they can pull on and push on to direct the direction of the economy and inflation and employment. And what you're hearing about a lot lately is the Fed funds rate. And that's simply a rate that the Fed sets. They set a target rate. And it's a rate that affects how big commercial banks lend each other and borrow from each other to manage their reserves. The Fed says if you're a bank and you have so many deposits and so many loans outstanding, you've got a capital level in your bank, and you need to hold reserves at the Federal Reserve Bank to safeguard your customers. And so they call that bank reserves. And the banks, in order to maintain those reserves or lend out those reserves, make a little money, borrow and lend from each other. And the Fed says, hey, we want you guys to be borrowing and lending from each other between 0 and 25 basis points currently, which is a super, super low Fed reserve target. The Fed they can't control where the banks transact. They set the target and then monitor where banks tend to borrow and lend from each other, and they call that the effective funds rate. And currently, that rate is about 8 basis points the last time I looked. So it's within that 0 to 25 basis point band. I should slow down here. A basis point that's part of the nomenclature that investment geeks use. What that is 0.01%. So 0.0001 in non-percentage. So it's a really small number, but it's a number that's important, and it's a number that people use to talk about. So it's banks talk about it, investment managers talk about it, and normal people don't. Typically. And that's really nice to talk to normal people and not have to talk about basis points. But so at any rate, so that's one of the levers the Fed uses. And so when you read about that in the newspapers or hear about that in the news, that's what they're talking about. The Fed's Fed funds rate target. The second lever that you don't hear as much about is the discount rate. And that's the rate at which banks can go directly to the Federal Reserve and borrow money to maintain their reserves. It's not as common. The Fed encourages commercial banks to lend to one another so that they don't have to be in that business of lending to banks. But it's an avenue out there for banks to pursue if they need to pursue that. And the third level is something you've probably heard about over the last few years. It really got popular back in the 2008-2009 Great Recession. And it's called quantitative easing. And it's the third lever that the Fed typically uses to help manipulate, if you will, interest rates. And that's a process where the Fed goes out into the bond markets and actually buys bonds from investors, from banks, from big investment firms. And so what they're doing is they buy typically treasury bonds and something called mortgage-backed securities, which is another big part of the bond market that's supported by federal agencies. And there's lots of these things out there. And Recently, the Fed over the last, I think it was June of 2020, shortly after the COVID crisis started to hit, the Fed committed to buying, and these are big numbers, but the Fed committed to buying $80 billion in U.S. treasuries. That's a, you know, that's a lot of money. A billion here, a billion, you know, they say a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon you're talking real money. And they also committed to buying $40 billion of mortgage-backed securities every month. That's $120 billion taken together every month that the Fed is investing, or that the Fed is actually going out into the market, buying the bonds. So they're taking the bonds in onto their balance sheet and pushing $120 billion of money out into the economy. The net effect of that is that there's just more money out in the economy sloshing around, and there are more bank reserves because the banks often sell their treasuries and then they take the cash, and then that cash can be applied to their reserves. So they can go out and lend more money based on those larger reserves that they have. And so that is supposed to be stimulative, because the banks can lend more money to people. I'm gonna say one more thing about it, Patrick, and that is when the Fed lowers the target Fed funds target rate, or it lowers the discount rate at which banks borrow from the Fed, or it goes out and starts buying a lot of bonds in quantitative easing. What they're doing in effect, to get back to the apple analogy, what they're doing in effect is putting 100 apples out on the shelf. They're trying to lower the cost of money, because when they lower the funds rate, they're making money cheaper for people to borrow. When they buy bonds, they're driving down interest rates, which move in the opposite direction of bond prices. And so when the Fed's buying bonds, they're driving up the prices, and the yields are coming down on those bonds. And the price of money is coming down across the yield curve for both short-term bonds and longer-term bonds. And all of that is important because when you think about it from a consumer standpoint, when the Fed makes money less expensive by lowering rates, you and I can go out and buy a refrigerator and finance it for very little. So we can buy a nice refrigerator. Or boy, you know, my car is getting a little old and these car loans are really cheap right now. I'm going to go buy a new car. Or man, you know, the kids are tearing the house apart. We want a bigger house. We can go out now and buy a bigger house because interest rates are lower. The cost of borrowing the money to buy a house or a car or a refrigerator is lower. So we can go out and buy stuff as consumers. And so that has a stimulative effect on economic growth, because now refrigerator makers have to go make more refrigerators, and car manufacturers have to make more cars, and home builders can build more houses. And so it's, you get into this virtuous cycle where money is cheap and people are borrowing and buying stuff, and then businesses have to make more of the stuff. It also impacts corporations because they can now say, hey, I can build that plant. And I've wanted to build this manufacturing facility for 5 years. Now the money's cheap enough so I can go out and borrow a bunch of money and build that plant, because then I can make more refrigerators to satisfy this increasing demand for refrigerators. So again, on the corporate side, it's a virtuous cycle. And that can ultimately then lead to rising corporate earnings, which helps the stock market. So the stock market likes this and goes higher. That's a really long answer to your question, but it's a great question, and it's a really interesting way that all of this fits together
Yeah, I was actually just going to say it's very much like a Rolling Stone scenario. You know, one thing leads to another, to another, to another. And so I understand that, you know, it is a very broad question to ask. It can just kind of roll into the next thing and the next thing. So very interesting. Thank you for your perspective on it. What I'd love to do now is we've talked kind of a relatively high level about all of these things, what interest rates are, how the feds make the decisions, you know, how these decisions kind of interact with different scenarios. When it comes to your experience, how have you seen interest rates directly impact the market? You talked a little bit about some of the impacts of interest rates, but I'd love to hear, you know, maybe a scenario or a situation that you've seen, you know, interest rates impact the market.
Yeah, a great question. And it's a really interesting question. And it, again, it's complicated. It's each time the Fed lowers rates or raises rates, different things can happen. Or another way to say that is each time the cost of money goes down or goes up, you don't always get the result you think you're going to get. So it's not, that's where the Apple analogy starts to break down. You know, the grocery store knows that it's got so many customers and they're going to come in and so many of them are going to want apples. And so if they put a lot of apples out there, they're going to sell them cheap. They put a few apples out there, they're going to get more per apple. But with the Fed, when they try to make money cheap and encourage the banks to lend it, something else has to happen. You and I have to be comfortable enough to want to go borrow that money. And if we don't borrow that money, those bank reserves don't do any good. And so here's what, there's this saying called pushing on a string. And it's a great image because if you envision a string sitting on top of your desk and you grab one end of it and start pushing, the other end of the string doesn't necessarily move. And so unless people go out and buy stuff and borrow money, or unless corporations borrow money and build manufacturing facilities and increase their property, plant, and equipment, the banks can sit there with all those reserves, but there is a stimulative effect. So when you ask, well, when the Fed does things, what is the impact on the economy or on the labor market or on inflation or on, I mean, man, or on, you know, on the stock market, it's not always clear. And so that's why you get tug of wars, you know, and certain investors say, well, the Fed's going to raise rates and that's going to destroy the stock market. And other investors say, well, you know, really, when you look back historically, the Fed can be raising rates for a while and stocks can be going up. And that's because often in the beginning of a tightening cycle, and it seems like that's where we are right now. In the beginning of a tightening cycle, the Fed starts tightening because it's a strong economy. There's some inflation and there is, and corporate earnings are rising. Those things can be good for the stock market and stocks can rally in the early quarters of a Fed tightening period. Not always. That hasn't been the case this year. We came into the year with a steamy stock market, and so we've corrected some year to date. But it's not always clear exactly why we've corrected. The market was, maybe it was overvalued. We hadn't had a correction in a long time. Maybe we were just due. Investors get too aggressive and have to, you know, relax a little bit or take a little bit off the table and do some selling. That can beget selling. And so that can, you know, markets, it's all about human behavior. And it's all about what investors are perceiving about the future. And then we run our mathematical models and come up with valuations that we think are reasonable. And then we buy and sell stocks based on those models. And math is involved. Human behavior and sentiment are just as potent a factor in how these markets are are valued and traded. But so I'm sorry to give you another long answer, but there's just no simple answer to some of these questions. And so in my experience, when the Fed is in a tightening cycle, as we appear to be now, stocks can keep running for a while. And eventually stocks are going to flatten out the performance. So, and you could see a sell-off. I mean, we haven't had one for so long. You could see a 10, 15, 20% sell-off. That wouldn't be uncommon. That wouldn't necessarily be worrisome because it happens all the time. Most years we have significant corrections of 10 to 20% in the stock market, and then it bounces right back and keeps on going. So unless the Fed really gets too aggressive, and there are lots of reasons why I don't think they're going to get too aggressive, I think the stock market is going to, you know, it'll probably, you know, it's been going down and it might wiggle around some more, but by year end, it's likely that we'll see higher rate, higher interest rates potentially, and higher stock market valuations. Do you want me to comment on how this impacts various sectors within the stock market?
I think if it's something that you think would be valuable for the audience to know, let's jump into that. It's not a bad idea.
Yeah. And just like rates can impact the stock market in different ways, in different kinds of environments, it can also impact sectors in unexpected ways. I mean, early on, and we've expected this year, now we've expected the finance sector to do very well. And in fact, it has. The reason for that is that for a while there, the yield curve was steepening. And when the yield curve steepens, meaning the differential between longer treasury rates or longer borrowing rates and short-term borrowing rates, banks can go out and borrow short at low rates and lend long at higher rates. And they call that spread. And banks make more money typically in that environment. What happens though is if the Fed gets too aggressive and the economy starts to slow, and corporate earnings start to slow, credit quality in the companies to which banks are lending can diminish or deteriorate, at which point the bank balance sheets then have to worry about the quality of their loans, and then the finance sector can trade off. So it's this balancing act between, you know, what's going on with rates, what's going on with the yield curve, what are spread lenders doing, how are they benefiting, Are they taking too much risk? Are they, you know, it's just, but and again, in the early stages, the financial sector can do very well. In inflation-oriented sectors like energy can do very well. And we've seen energy do very well this year. It's a top-performing sector. If things start to slow because the Fed is raising rates or raising the cost of money, maybe you and I will buy fewer refrigerators going forward. That can hit the consumer discretionary sector. You know, things start to slow down. The consumer starts to slow its purchases of goods. It can impact the industrial sector because the industrials at the margin maybe don't build as many manufacturing facilities because it's starting to cost more to do that. So we're going to defer, let's say, we'll defer the investment in that property, plant and equipment, because it's getting a little more expensive. So that slows the earnings in the industrial sector. And so it can ripple through, it can even hit the tech sector because, you know, maybe the industrial company that was going to grow earnings at a certain rate is now going to slow earnings growth. So at the margin, they're going to buy fewer computers, or they're going to buy a little less software, or not going to invest in that cybersecurity they were going to invest. So even tech can slow down, even though it's not, you know, directly related, but it's indirectly. And of course, real estate is hugely impacted by rising interest rates. And the housing market is on a tear right now. So it's, you know, if the mortgage rate continues to go up, I saw 4%, a little over 4% recently in mortgage rates. I mean, it's starting to get a little more expensive to borrow money to buy a house. So that can tend to slow down the housing market, which isn't a bad thing. You know, it housing prices have been rising at unsustainable rates over the last couple of years, and I think they need to slow down. I mean, if I want to sell my house, I want them to keep running, you know. But just for the average buyer, you know, it's very difficult to buy a house, especially for new home purchases. Young people moving out of apartments into homes for the first time. It's really tough to find housing product. And now it's going to be more expensive to get in there and buy that house, so I might keep renting. Of course, that drives people into the rental market. And so we've seen rents going up. So it's another complicated answer, but it's all interrelated. And it's just really interesting how interest rates impact the economy and earnings and the stock market overall and individual sectors within the stock market.
Yeah. You've done my final question. You've kind of cut out a portion of that final question that I was going to ask, in just honestly how a portfolio manager analyzes these situations in the different sectors and how it's impacting the economy and all this. You've kind of broken that out already, the analysis process of, okay, we're seeing this, we're seeing it impact this. And now I kind of want to take that question and pull it into a little deeper of a conversation in that, you know, after you do the analysis, how does it impact what you do on a day-to-day basis as a portfolio manager?
Yeah, that's another one more great question. And the way we are thinking about it at Stonebridge is we always focus on high quality companies. Today we're continuing that focus, obviously. And we're also looking to companies that do well in inflationary environments. We're looking to companies that are stable, relatively stable companies, often companies in the consumer staples sector do well. Often healthcare companies can do well. People still get sick and need doctors and hospitals and clinics. And so there are sectors that are relatively insulated from inflation or from higher interest rates or from just volatile stock markets in general. We look for companies that have got good, strong balance sheets and sustainable earnings streams and that are in sectors that can weather a storm better than others, better than more sensitive, more volatile sectors. Now, there are times to own those more volatile sectors when you think the economy is taking off and we're going to have a lot of earnings growth. And, you know, then you want to get into a company that's going to grow its earnings and go, and investors start to flock to those companies. But what we've seen lately is investors starting to favor more stable companies, staples, energy. We still need to consume gas, right? I still got to go fill my car up with gas. Companies still need to run their plants. And so those sectors, and people are still getting sick, like I said earlier. So some of those sectors tend to be a little more insulated than others to periods where interest rates are a little less certain, it's a little less certain where the consumer is going to be in a year from now. And markets like to look out a year and anticipate what earnings and economic growth are going to be.
Yep.
I can keep going.
Sure. No, absolutely. I think that was a really good kind of overview of you know, how you all, analyze the market, analyze the situations that's going on with the Fed are trying to do, whether governments are trying to do, but then how that all impacts the things that are going on then in our clients' portfolios, right? How we're making those decisions. Our process is based on customized, right? We really focus on identifying, you know, those client needs, what their goals are, and trying to find the right situation and the right matchup for them when it comes to their investments and their goals. And we have to understand what's going on outside of what we're seeing in the market and kind of gauge how things are trending when it comes to what the government and what interest rates are doing. So I think that was plenty on what you provided there.
We've actually seen that in our across our three different equity strategies. Mm-hmm. And in inflationary environments, often dividend stocks do well. And we've seen our dividend income strategy outperform the other two strategies. Mm-hmm. So there are environments in which that strategy will outperform the others. And then there are other environments where the growth strategy will outperform the dividend strategy and the growth and income strategy, because growth is in favor. So now is a time when dividend income is in favor. It's difficult to anticipate just how long one strategy is going to outperform another. So like you said, it's a long-term horizon. And for clients who want to grow their capital more at the margin, the growth strategy is still appropriate. For clients who are focused more on the income, the dividend strategy is always going to be preferable. Even though it's not going to grow as much, it's going to generate more. And in the middle, then, we have the growth and income strategy for folks who are more comfortable in the middle of that with their investment goals. So, but we've seen that, in fact, year to date.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's good. I think we're going to wrap it up here for today. Again, a lot of things that are kind of a rolling stone scenario. We could talk about them for hours and hours, each one of these questions. So, I appreciate you coming in with these ideas and kind of bringing them down into nice boxes for each one of us to take away and get some understanding around. Brad, your insight has been great today. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope you enjoyed the experience here. To all of our listeners out there, thank you so much for joining us. And to find all of our sound bites, please visit stonebridgecap.com/news. If you would like to learn a little bit more or even speak to Brad about any of these questions here that he answered, you can certainly give us a call at any time. You can call us directly at 651-251-1000, and we'd love to hear from you. Again, thank you all for joining us and have an excellent day.